Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
God, he said quietly. Isn't the sea what Algy calls it? A grey, sweet mother? This not green sea, the scrotum tightening sea. Epi oinapa pontum. Ah, Daedalus, the Greeks. I must teach you. You must read them in the original. Thalata, thalata.
His project as an author was not just to evoke the city, but to build it up in words, in his texts, to restore it to power, and also to awaken all its inhabitants.
For that day, everybody is a Joycean scholar, and everyone has their favourite song, and everybody is a Molly or a Blazes.
Stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lava on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. That's the opening sentence of Ulysses by James Joyce, his sprawling, magnificent, monstrous masterpiece. T.S. Eliot called Ulysses a book to which we are all indebted and from which none of us can escape. And Virginia Woolf described it as the excrescence of a queasy undergraduate scratching his pimples. Ulysses was first published in book form in Paris 100 years ago, on Joyce's 40th birthday, the 2nd of February, the second month, 1922. Ever since, it has scandalized, intimidated, and obsessed readers, and it has been the yardstick against which subsequent novelists have been forced to measure themselves. As Anthony Burgess wrote, everybody knows now that Ulysses is the greatest novel of the century. Hello, and welcome to On the Road with Penguin Classics, the podcast that takes a stroll around the world's favourite books. I'm Henry Elliott, the author of the Penguin Classics book, and in this episode, I'll be drifting around Joyce's Dublin, tracing the footsteps of Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom.
Wow, amazing. That's so good.
Now, Ulysses famously takes place over a single day, June the 16th, 1904. It starts at 8 a.m. in the morning, and it begins on the top of a Martello tower on the coast in Sandy Cove, just on the outskirts of Dublin. And I'm standing at the top of that very Martello tower now, looking out over the sea and round to Dublin Bay, which curves round in a huge sweep of land in a really rather spectacular way. And it's my pleasure to introduce at the top of this Martello Tower our guest for today, Anne Fogarty, the Professor of James Joyce Studies at University College Dublin. She's had that position since 2006, and of course, University College Dublin is James Joyce's own alma mater, so very appropriate place for a chair of James Joyce Studies. Anne has written and spoken widely about Joyce. She's organised 3 international James Joyce symposia and was president of the International James Joyce Foundation from 2008 to 2012. So really, I couldn't think of a better person to be joining us today to talk about Ulysses. Anne, welcome. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you very much. And it's wonderful to start here in the Martello Tower. And Joyce chose this location because he had spent a few days. He had stayed with these two friends, Gogarty, who's Buck Mulligan, a kind of dandyish, Wildean figure in the novel, and Haynes, whom he casts as an Englishman, but who actually is Irish, with an Anglo-Irish background. And the tower itself is symbolic simply because of its vista. It seems to be bringing a kind of a stage Englishman and two stage Irishmen together, and it gives us a kind of mini drama, all the animosities between these three men.
From a very practical point of view, it's a really spectacular place to set that opening scene. And for a novel that's so intrinsically set in Dublin, it's a wonderful spot to get this this incredible, you know, we can see the whole of the setting of Dublin. This is, the city is here in front of us.
And you can see the hinterland of Dublin, so you see to the Dublin Mountains, as they're called. They look like hills, in fact. And you get this wide panorama. But there's also a sense that we're on the edge of things. We're on the seashore, and we're looking towards the UK, but also towards Europe, the Mediterranean. Yes. So for Joyce, this place connects Ireland with the world, but it also introduces us to the big problem of Irish history, the fact that Ireland is a colony in the period, occupied still by Britain, and colonised by many other things as well, by the Catholic Church, by Irish subservience, Irish politics.
And just rewinding a little bit, can you remember how you first got interested in Joyce, and what was your introduction to his work?
I think I'm unusual in being one of the academics who came to Joyce later, in that when I did my degree in English, there was very little 20th century literature. So Joyce for me was kind of extracurricular. I studied German and spent a summer in Germany, and that's when I started reading Ulysses.
Wow.
I sort of rediscovered my own literature and so on, and Joyce seemed perfectly European and different and other and difficult, and so I wanted to tackle him.
Fantastic. And well, we'll talk a bit later about, you know, how Ulysses was almost entirely written on the continent, so that feels rather appropriate that you came to him there. Now, yes, you mentioned this opening scene is this sort of dance between these three friends in this quite confined space of the Martello Tower, and in particular one of those characters becomes one of the key characters of the book, Stephen Dedalus, who readers of Joyce would have already known because he is the central character of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And in many ways, he is a kind of autobiographical character, very similar to Joyce himself. So, Anne, can you just, for our listeners, introduce this character, Stephen? He's 22 years old at the start of Ulysses. What's he like as a character?
He's disaffected. He has returned from Paris. He is an artist in the making, although he writes very little. He's a version of Joyce, but he's also not Joyce. He seems like a continuation of the Stephen Dedalus that we all identify with in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, but yet he's somehow other, and he seems somehow stranded and marooned. He's lost his way. He has returned to Dublin, like Joyce himself, summoned because his mother was dying in the summer of 1903. Stephen is still in mourning for his mother. He has refused to pray at her bedside, which would have been a major failing in the period in an Ireland that was totally devotional and religious and Catholic.
And so, am I right, Joyce did the same? He also...
Refused
to pray at his mother's deathbed.
And Joyce was devoted to his mother. His correspondence with his mother is remarkable. And so the death of his mother really marked Joyce, but also marks Stephen, the character. And it's untransacted. So in the course of the novel, Stephen has to deal with the ghost of his mother, the ghost of his own rebelliousness, and try and make sense of all of this.
Fascinating. And he has this phrase, doesn't he, Agenbite of Inwit, which recurs a few times. And that, I think it's a quotation from an old English poem, but in a very concise way, it has that sort of that inner angst contained in it, doesn't it?
Yes.
Agenbite of Inwit.
Yes, indeed. And it also captures what is part of the big artistic project of Ulysses, to get inside our heads and to get inside the minds of the characters. I guess the phrase we use most often to describe this effect is stream of consciousness. It's not really precise. It doesn't capture everything that Joyce does, but he gives us a sense of the way in which we interact with the world unconsciously, mentally, psychically, emotionally, all the time to the language of his characters. And their thoughts keep disrupting the narrative of the novel.
And in terms of Joyce himself at the age of 22, you know, he in many ways is very similar to Stephen. He'd lived in Paris for a little while. He comes back to be there at his mother's bedside. And in 1904, when the novel is set, he was also sort of a bit listless and sort of drifting around Dublin, not sure where the future was going to lead him.
Yes, he imagined many different kinds of vocations for himself, even though he always wanted to be an artist. He seems always to have been the chosen member in his family. He came from a big family of siblings, but his genius was always evident to everybody that he met. He very conspicuously made friends or introduced himself to all of the members of what we know of as the Irish Literary Revival, W.B. Yes. Yeats, A.E., who is George Russell, Lady Gregory, and so on. And John Millington Synge, whom he meets in Paris. Dublin is very intimate and close-knit in the period. They meet this young man who's written very little, a few poems and what he calls epiphanies, little prose poems, vignettes, but they're all immediately taken by Joyce. He is impossible. He's arrogant, brilliant, radical, a contrarian. He refuses all their ideas. He admires them to death. He's an absolute devotee of Yeats and Synge, but he's also adamant he's never going to go their way. He famously said to Yeats at the end of their interview, "You are too old for me," that he's met Yeats too late for Joyce to influence him and to change him around. So he seems to have been absolutely preposterous on one level. The ultimate everlasting undergraduate who was against everything, but absolute radical as well. And people were convinced by him even before the writing really got going. They knew he was going to write these brilliant works.
How
in some ways. And Joyce himself sort of pre-knows it too.
Fascinating. Well, before we head down, let's just savour the scene from up here and remember that opening moment where Buck Mulligan is shaving himself on this very parapet where we're standing. And there's yes. that wonderful moment where he sort of addresses the sea that we're looking at now with the words of Xenophon, "Thalatta, Thalatta,"
yes.
And famously describes it as the snot-green sea, the scrotum-tightening sea.
Yes.
Well, today, I have to say, it's not snot green at all. It's beautifully twinkly blue in a most lovely sunshine.
And I think it almost never is snot right. green. But this, of course, is a snide comment about Irish nationalism, the right. greenness of Irish nationalism.
Right.
But it's also toppling. It's iconoclastic as a description of the
course.
Sea. Possibly not realistic at all, but absolutely memorable, of course,
very
as well.
Memorable. And I suspect that the sea probably is scrotum tightening, even if it's not.
I'm sure.
That's
for people of a certain anatomy to,
yes,
to explore.
To explain. We're looking, there are several swimmers down at the 40-foot gentleman's bathing place where Buck Mulligan, of course, swims at the end of this episode. So we've actually just hopped into a taxi cab now and we're heading back into central Dublin. But on this journey, let's just talk about the next couple of episodes in Ulysses. Because when Stephen first leaves the tower, he first makes his way to, actually away from Dublin, into Dalkey, the village
yes.
of Dalkey, where he visits the school where he's working as a teacher and has an interview with the headmaster. And am I right, Joyce himself worked at this same Summerfield Lodge school
yes,
for a few
yes,
weeks.
Yes, and the building still survives.
Brilliant. So that's the second episode. And then when Stephen leaves the school, he travels towards Dublin along the coast and stops for a walk on Sandymount Strand, the beach that stretches between this part of the bay and the city of Dublin.
Yes.
And this is a wonderful episode known as the Proteus episode, where we really get inside Stephen's mind and inside his poetic way of thinking, would you say?
Indeed, yes. And the style changes. This mm-hmm. is one of the first episodes that really experiments with this so-called stream of consciousness.
Yes.
And Proteus is the god of change, of metamorphosis, so language becomes very malleable. And some people find Proteus as an episode off-putting, but I love the poetry of it, its literariness, Stephen's meditations on life. It's vulgar as well. Stephen is urinating, picking his nose. There are two old women who are thought of as midwives who are bringing maybe a kind of aborted fetus to the strand.
Gosh, and yeah, he describes walking on the sand and the very beach is breathing upwards sewage breath. It's, it's dirty.
Yes, and these are all the layers of history in Dublin time and the layeredness of a city as well. It's full of detritus, rubbish, but all full of meaning from the point of view of the artist and a thinker like Stephen.
Definitely, I found reading Ulysses as a newcomer, this is the first episode where you think, okay, this is harder than what I've read before. And I hope I'm getting to where you are and where you can kind of embrace that.
Yes, I think there's a kind of competition amongst non-readers of Ulysses about the point where they gave up. Some people stop even sooner than Proteus, but some decide this was it.
This
did them in. But one thing to do with Ulysses is to listen to it. It's very oral and performative, and you kind of get over a lot of your difficulties if you hear actors voicing it for you, and you can go with the flow of the text much more.
I'm sure you're right. Let's talk about how it came to be written. It's famously on the final page of Ulysses, he writes Trieste, Zurich, Paris, 1914 to 1921.
Yes.
And that's to indicate that he wrote this book during the years of the First World War.
Exactly.
In three different European cities. So what was the process of writing this book and how did it come to be published?
Of course, it's a long work. It's an epic work. So he writes it slowly, relatively slowly and incrementally with great difficulty while he's enduring all kinds of dislocations. He himself is in exile by the First World War. There's the border crossing from the Austro-Hungarian Empire into Switzerland, Feldkirch. The train is stopped there while Nora and Joyce and the two children are fleeing. And he says that the future of Ulysses was decided on this track because he was worried that they would be sent back and he would have been interned.
Nora was his wife, of course. We're going to talk about her later.
Yes. So luckily he got to Zurich and then gradually they moved on to Paris where the rest of Ulysses is published. And yes, you're right, the major conflict of the 20th century, the big upheaval of the First World War, is the backdrop of the novel implicitly, and of course also the 1916 rising in Ireland. One scholar has said that Ulysses has a date and a duration. There's the one day, 1904, but there's that period of composition unfurling in the background.
Anne, can you tell us how Ulysses came to be published? Because initially it was serialised in America, is that right?
Yes, and Joyce, with all his works, ran into censorship problems. Some of it had to do with his hyper-realism in the first instance, say, with Dubliners. The publishers were taken aback by the fact that he was naming real-life individuals, real-life institutions, pubs, shops, and so on, and they were worried about litigation. But, of course, there was also the scandalous, uncensored aspect of all of Joyce's embrace of the world, which was found to be shocking. His very frank discussions of the human body. And Ulysses is heroically published, serialized in the Little Review, but not completely. It constantly came up against objections from readers.
So and 13 so, and a half of yes. the 18 chapters were serialized between March 1918 and December 1920.
Yes.
And then this court case stopped the
yes.
serialization.
Yeah. And Joyce had endeavoured to get the book published in lots of different places. Hogarth Press, for instance.
Yes, Virginia Woolf read it, yes. didn't she? And I think wanted to publish it, but it was just too much on
that. That's it, yes. Often Woolf is seen as someone who was antipathetic to Joyce just because she made this comment about him as being like some undergrad.
We heard that
picking
earlier, yes.
His acne. But at the same time, she was very much inspired by him. And Mrs. Dalloway is another kind of remodelling of Ulysses in a family. humanist vein, but they don't publish. And so once again, another heroic woman steps into the breach, and this is Sylvia Beach, mm-hmm. who basically privately, she finds the funding, creates subscription lists, and has the book published.
And now she's living in Paris. She's running the bookshop Shakespeare and Company.
Indeed.
Which still...
And she, like a lot of the other people who encountered Joyce, absolutely believed in his genius. It's not an accident that it's published, but there were a lot of obstacles put in Joyce's way.
So we're now, the taxi's just pulling into central Dublin, and... we're approaching the moment where we're going to meet the second of the main characters in Ulysses. So we're now in central Dublin, at one of the most famous addresses in literature. We're standing on the site of 7 Eccles Street, which is the home in the novel of Leopold and Molly Bloom. The original 7 Eccles Street doesn't exist anymore. It's now, there's a large red brick private hospital on the site, but there's a plaque on the side of the hospital with a relief bust of Joyce with his round spectacles peering out of it sideways. In fact, he's kind of pinning me with his blank stare at the moment. And in fact, if we look on the opposite side of the street, we can see number 77, which is very similar to how number 7 would have looked. Anne, are you happy to describe it to us? What does the house look like?
They're 4-storey red brick. There's a basement area, and another facet of the layout of the houses that's interesting is the very large drop into that basement area, what Bloom actually had to do.
Yes, had to break into his house at the end.
You need to be quite athletic to do this. So they're quite grand houses in their own rights, but they became tenements in due course. And that's why these houses were looked down upon, actually, in modern Dublin. I might explain why Eccles Street disappeared. Joyce knew the house because a friend of his had sublet it. It's fictional and it's real.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leopold Bloom, who lives here at number 7 Eccles Street, is in many ways the main character of Ulysses. In some ways, he is the Ulysses of the novel. And maybe this is a good moment to talk about the fact that this novel is called Ulysses and that it's modelled on this great sort of foundation epic of European literature, the Odyssey by Homer. Of course, the Latin name of Odysseus was Ulysses.
Yes.
And what Joyce does at this point in the novel is rewinds. We started at 8 a.m. and then we went through the next few hours. We're now back at 8 a.m. again.
That's right. Ulysses, in effect, begins twice.
Right. And that is a direct reference to the Odyssey, which has a opening section all about Telemachus, Ulysses' son. And then there's a sort of cinematic edit, and we're now with Odysseus, and we follow his story through. And so, that, we're now with Bloom. But, Anne, can I ask, what was Joyce doing by modelling this great modern novel on the most fundamental epic work of ancient Greek literature?
He was doing many things. It's precisely what you called it there. It is fundamental. So he's going back to a kind of ur-text, ur-literary text, but it's a text that's at a crossroads as well between the oral and the written. Homer was many figures. He wasn't a single historical Homer figure, we think. He's an amalgam of a lot of different writers and of oral texts that were passed on and preserved. And Joyce sees himself in a similar position. But also Homer gives some quintessential narratives. Adventures, wandering, return, fidelity, treachery. The Odyssey is an epic that has a lot of war stories implicit in it, but it's an epic about aftermaths. What comes next? What comes later? And about
because, of course, it follows on from the Iliad about the Trojan War.
It's the
return from...
But it's not about war per se, even though Odysseus is a warrior.
Right. And then when Joyce was writing Ulysses, he thought each episode in his novel as being explicitly modelled on an episode from the Odyssey. And he would talk, in his letters to friends and so on, he would refer to them by these names. Like this episode where he introduces Bloom was called Calypso, for instance, which is where we first meet Odysseus in the Odyssey. But he chose not to include those titles in the book. And how do you feel about these parallels? Because do you feel there's a sense in which they're useful to him in the writing process, but he wants to distance himself from it to some extent?
I think he arrived at that point, and that's what a lot of the early scholars of Joyce and Ulysses also thought. So Ezra Pound, for instance, and friends of Joyce, they saw it as a scaffolding that he needed, a way of promoting Ulysses in advance. You know, he would tell people, I'm writing a novel based on Homer's Odyssey, but that then he grew away from it, that he could pull the scaffolding away. One of the reasons he was devoted to the Odyssey was he read first Lamb's children's version of the Odyssey, and in fact has the same episodes in Ulysses as Lamb featured in the first version of the Odyssey that he wrote as a young boy.
Now, before we leave this spot, let's talk a bit more about Bloom. So he is 38-year-old, Jewish, Irish, advertising canvasser. He works for a newspaper sort of arranging advertising by brokering deals. And can you tell us more about this character? Introduce our listeners to Leopold Bloom.
For a lot of people, Leopold Bloom really is Ulysses. He's pivotal. I think he's one of the most beloved characters in 20th century literature. We all find ourselves in him. We all are Bloom.
I completely agree. We'll talk about this across the day, but he's just such a warm-spirited man. You sort of warmed him instantly, I think.
Yes, and he's quirky, eccentric. Yes, yes. He does the wrong thing sometimes. He's perhaps a very surprising figure because he's a Jewish Dubliner. So there was a small but quite influential Jewish population in Dublin in the period. And Bloom actually isn't representative of the Dublin Jews of the period, some of whom Joyce would have known. Bloom has a greater kinship with the cosmopolitan Eastern European Jews that Joyce knew in Trieste and environs.
Like, for instance, the author Italus Favo, I think.
Exactly, yeah. But he's Irish. He's one of the few characters in the novel to claim Irish citizenship. He belongs to several different religions and none. So he's a perfect cosmopolitan displaced individual, a kind of cipher of the modern hero.
Now, we've already had one breakfast scene at the Martello Tower, but we meet Bloom preparing breakfast for his wife, Molly Bloom. And Molly, of course, is an amateur opera singer, a little bit younger than Leopold. And they have a daughter, Millie, who, again, we don't meet. She's living outside of Dublin. She's 15. And importantly, they have had a baby son called Rudy, who died as a baby.
11 days, yeah.
And he returns to Leopold's thoughts over the course of the day. Now, this episode, which introduces Bloom, sets up various strands which we're going to follow through the novel. One is that he's dressed in black because he's going to be attending a funeral today. It also sets up his relationship with Molly because when the Morning Post arrives, it includes a letter which he knows is arranging an adulterous meeting for her later that day.
Yes.
And that, of course, will return. And also it sets the kind of scatological tone which often accompanies Bloom, because there's a famous scene where he goes out to the outhouse in the garden and reads a couple of columns of the newspaper, and we'd read between the lines of what he's doing in the lavatory. But let's move on now. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Dublin, and let's leave the house as Bloom does in this opening episode. He sets off to buy the food for his breakfast, so let's follow in his footsteps now.
He crossed to the bright side, avoiding the loose cellar flap of number 75. The sun was nearing the steeple of George's Church. Be a warm day, I fancy. Especially in these black clothes, feel it more. Black conducts, reflects, refracts, is it? The heat. But I couldn't go in that light suit and make a picnic of it. His eyelids sank quietly often as he walked in happy warmth. Boland's bread van delivering with trays are daily, but she prefers yesterday's loaves, turnovers, crisp, crowns, hot. Makes you feel young.
This is north side already, so you already get a sense of Joyce's Dublin, because it hasn't been gentrified much.
This episode opens with the line that Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls.
Yes.
Amazing opening sentence.
Yeah.
And we're with him now on his way to the local butcher to find those inner organs.
Yeah. And it's amusing and quirky. It gives us a sense of Bloom already. And he's essential as somebody who ingests the world, takes things in,
absolutely,
eats things.
So we're passing what used to be Larry O'Rourke's pub, which
yes,
was the pub that was there,
yes,
right? Now
indeed,
it seems to be called the Eccles,
yes,
Townhouse,
yeah,
a cafe, bar and deli. But we, yeah, can imagine it as O'Rourke's. Leopold has a little thought where he says it would be a good puzzle would be to cross Dublin without passing a pub.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
You still can't do it.
Yes. And, you know, what? Walking as we are through Dublin, Joyce was born in Dublin, grew up here. All of his works are set in Dublin, and yet nearly all of them were written somewhere else. Why do you think this city was so important to him as a writer?
There was a sense in Dublin in the late 19th century, Joyce was born in 1882, that Dublin had ceded power. It was once a grand city, but after the Act of Union, when the centre of government moves to Westminster, Dublin became, as one historian calls it, a deposed capital. And Joyce, I think, had a sense from the writing of Dubliners On that what his project was as an author was not just to evoke the city, but to build it up in words, in his texts, to restore it to power and also to awaken all its inhabitants. He's also just steeped in Dublin lore and knowledge through his family and particularly through his father, who was a witty man, full of anecdotes and scurrilous stories about characters in Dublin. And Joyce, in a way, was modelling himself on his father and continuing this history onwards.
I love that. He once said that he was more interested in the street names of Dublin than in the riddle of the universe.
Yes, and when people visited him in Paris late in life, that was one of the games he would play. He would go up and down a street mentally with them, naming the shops and other buildings, and they would tell him what had changed in the meantime.
Wow. So we're just walking down now towards O'Connell Street, one of the largest streets in Dublin, which leads down to a bridge over the river. And this is a good place, perhaps, to talk about the next episode in the novel, which is known as Hades. And a large section of that episode is a journey by horse-drawn carriage through the streets of Dublin towards the big cemetery in the north of the city where Bloom is attending a funeral.
And one of the concepts within the Hades chapter is not just that they're attending a funeral of Paddy Dignam.
Yes.
But that also Dublin is a city of the dead, so that literally all around them are vestiges of dead things, and particularly the statues that they pass on the main streets. O'Connell Street is still punctuated by very many of these statues that are in the same position. Some have moved, are being duly noted as kind of calcified emblems of various conflicts in Irish society.
So, for instance, we're standing now next to the Parnell Monument, which in 1904, in fact, was just a foundation stone, and they comment on it as they pass it, but now it's standing there in the middle of this large traffic junction.
It's just a foundation stone, so unfinished. So it gives you a sense that the whole project of Parnell, home rule for Ireland, Irish independence, freedom from British rule, is unfinished.
Right.
But also maybe has stalled, has come to a halt. And Bloom thinks about the foundation stone in terms of what happened to Parnell in quite romantic terms of breakdown and heart, that he died of a broken heart because of being betrayed by some of the Irish people who turned their back on him.
So after the funeral, the next episode in the novel shifts location from North Dublin down to here in the very centre of the city. We're standing on Middle Abbey Street now, which is one of the streets off O'Connell Street. And the action moves into the offices of the newspaper, the Freeman's Journal, which was a real daily newspaper published in Ireland. It was later absorbed into the Irish Independent in 1925, and that paper is still published daily.
Yes, but not from here anymore.
Not from here. We're standing outside the offices. It looks rather boarded up right now.
Yeah.
But the action moves here because Leopold Bloom is doing some work now. And am I right that Joyce's own father occasionally took work as an advertising canvasser with the journal?
Yeah.
So Joyce would have known what this involved.
It's an episode about rhetoric, which is one of the symbols of the episode, about language, but language in all its forms. Even the machines talk, the typesetting machines within the office are part of the things that we hear. And the discussion is about the Irish language, also about events in Irish history, and how information gets passed into newspapers.
Of course, this episode has an unusual format because, you know, appropriately for newspaper offices, it's organized as a series of headlines and then paragraphs under the headlines. Increasingly, the headlines seem to bear almost no relation to what comes underneath them, but you wonder if that is even a comment on the state of the
Indeed,
press.
Indeed, and they're often comic, very, very vivid, but they seem to go off on a tangent.
Right.
So it's language doing its own thing. Joyce actually added the crossheads very late in the writing process. So certainly it mimics a newspaper, but it's doing something very different to newspaper style. But it's Joyce certainly looking at the way in which we encounter language in the modern era, where we see snippets that are discordant, that don't necessarily mesh with what the article beneath it, for instance.
And gosh, that's only increased over the last century, hasn't it?
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Stephen Dedalus leaves and goes with some friends to the pub Mooney's, which is still there, just on the other side of O'Connell Street. His father, Simon, comes out and goes to the Oval pub, which I'm looking at now. It's a little bit closer. And Bloom heads out of the newspaper offices and walks towards the National Library in order to consult an advert in another newspaper. So let's follow in his footsteps towards O'Connell Bridge. And now we're standing on the bridge over the River Liffey, the really the heart of Dublin here, aren't we?
Yes, indeed. And the city, in a way, now has turned its back to the river a good deal, but it would have been very lively in Joyce's day with a lot of traffic on the on the river, goods being transported, basically, particularly barrels of Guinness being exported. That Bloom sees when he stands here in Lestergonians on the bridge and feeds Banbury cakes to the seagulls.
Yes, so initially he throws a piece of paper at the seagulls, right?
Yes, the throwaway.
And they sort of squawk at it. And,
yes.
And then he feels guilty, but he's cheated the seagulls.
Yes, and then feeds the gulls, but then is slightly disgusted by what they do.
We've crossed the bridge now. We're going to pass the front entrance to Trinity College, which, as Bloom passes, he just comments, Trinity's surly front.
Yeah, most of his allusions to Trinity are quite disparaging.
Is that as an alumnus of University College?
Yeah, there's still a rivalry between us. Trinity was the Protestant foundation, so you couldn't have attended Trinity in the period as a Catholic. And even in quite recent eras, people who went there who were Catholics had to get permission from their bishop to attend Trinity because it was seen as a godless university.
Wow. Now, it's at about this point, sort of more or less when he's passing Trinity, that the famous Irish writer A.E., the pseudonym for George Russell, passes him on a bicycle. And actually, George Russell enters the novel less fleetingly a bit later on, so we'll talk about him a bit later. But it's another of these sort of linking moments where a character passes Bloom and then meets Stephen later.
Yes, and Russell is linked with the strand of the literary revival that Joyce was interested in, but also tended to satirise those who were interested in theosophy and mysticism and vegetarianism and so on, and Russell is linked with this group.
Uh-huh.
So Grafton Street is ahead.
Okay. Now, like Bloom, we're about to step away from the tram lines and the road onto the pedestrianised Grafton Street, one of the key shopping streets in Dublin.
Indeed.
As it was in 1904.
South Side, anyway.
We're just passing a rather smart department store called Brown Thomas, which which Bloom also passes and pauses outside. He says, dallying, the windows of Brown Thomas, silk mercers, cascades of ribbons, flimsy China silks, a tilted urn poured from its mouth a flood of blood-hued poplin, lustrous blood. And, well, there's no... there aren't sort of cascades of silk, but there are some very impressive window displays still in the windows of Brown Thomas, some gold sort of globes and moons, and you can imagine that Bloom would have stopped to dally here when
yes,
he'd been walking past.
Yes, and you can see how the different senses are intermingling here. The materials in the window are reminding him of food, and the food
yes.
in turn is awakening his appetite, reminding him he's hungry, but it's also turning into disgust.
Yes, with the blood. And
one of the symbols, or one of the ways in which the imagery in the chapter works, is not just that people are eating and ingesting food, but that the whole of Dublin is a big digestive canal, and all of the citizens are being passed through as tracked,
oh
being
my
chewed
goodness,
up
like a big
and
gut
up.
Kind of, wow. Well, rather like Bloom, who gets increasingly hungry through this chapter.
Yes.
I'm also starting to feel rather hungry, so why don't we go, like Bloom, let's turn the next corner and look for somewhere to eat.
Yeah.
So we're just turning off Grafton Street now into Duke Street, and this is where Bloom in the novel is really getting hungry and looking for somewhere to eat. And now on our left here is a restaurant which today is called the Bailey Bar and Cafe. In 1904, it was called the Burton Hotel and Billiard Rooms, but it's the same building, still a restaurant. And initially, Bloom thinks he's going to eat in here, and he steps inside.
That's right.
And it's one of the most sort of grotesque descriptions in the novel. He says, stink gripped his trembling breath, pungent meat juice, slush of greens, see the animals feed, men, men, men. Perched on high stools by the bar, hats shoved back, at the tables calling for more bread, no charge, swilling, wolfing gobfuls of sloppy food, their eyes bulging, wiping wetted moustaches. Just, and it goes on, I mean, that's just a sort of a moment, but it's just a horrible description. And, of course, in the Odyssey, the episode that this section is based on is the Laestrygonians who were cannibals, and
yes.
so you get this image of the sort of grossest elements
yes.
of eating.
And it's also just the perpetual cycles of material in Dublin as well, that things that get eaten, of course, in due course, get turned into waste, but in turn the waste will recirculate. This is a novel full of rubbish and detritus and shocking items like these descriptions, but this is all part of the patterns of life that Joyce wants to represent.
Uh-huh. But we don't want to be too down on the Bailey Bar and Cafe today, and in fact... this is an important spot for us today, because when 7 Eccles Street was finally demolished, a group of writers, including Flann O'Brien, clubbed together to save the original front door of 7 Eccles Street. And for a long time, that door was on display here at the Bailey Restaurant. So
That's
they
right.
preserved it for a long time. It's not here now, and we may find it
yeah.
later today.
Yes.
Bloom sort of staggers out of this restaurant. He can't bear to eat in there. And instead crosses the street to the pub Davy Burns, which he just describes with a very simple two-word description, moral pub.
Yes.
And, you know, at the time, Davy Byrne still ran the pub himself.
Yes.
Bloom describes him. He says, he doesn't chat, stands a drink and now and then, but in leap year once in four, so
yes.
only occasionally. And it's here that he goes for lunch. And rather remarkably, Davy Burns, the moral pub, is still operating, still called Davy Burns. And we're going to pop inside and have some lunch now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Well, we've just come out of Davy Burns. Leopold Bloom, of course, eats a gorgonzola sandwich with mustard with a glass of Burgundy. And sadly, that wasn't on the menu, unfortunately, but we managed to have some deep-fried chunks of gorgonzola and a glass of Burgundy. So we got close. But anyway, after lunch, Bloom comes out of Davy Burns and heads on towards the National Library. So let's follow in his footsteps in the same direction. So we've just crossed over to in front of the Irish Doyle, the Parliament building. And on either side of the courtyard, we can see the sort of mirror images of the National Library and the National Museum.
Yes.
And in this episode in the book is known as Scylla and Charybdis, after the monsters from the Odyssey.
Yes.
But in a way, these two sort of opposite buildings feel a bit like these kind of counterparts facing each other across this courtyard. Now, here we are outside the library. And this, Anne, is really a key location for Irish literature, right? All the great Irish authors have walked up these steps and into the front door there.
Yes.
You know, Yeats, Synge, George Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, you know, all the most famous names of Irish literature have congregated at this spot.
Yeah.
Stephen is already in the library before Bloom gets here. And he's sort of holding forth on his theories on Shakespeare, right?
Yes, and it's one of the highlights of the day. It's already been flagged for us by Haynes and Buck Mulligan in the opening episode. They know this is what Stephen is going to do. It was also a very significant moment in Joyce's own life. His theory of Shakespeare was something that he evolved in that key year, 1904, in the summer. And curiously as well, Stephen the artist delivers what seems to be like a literary critical lecture. So it's a grand disquisition.
Stephen, in this library building, does gather some real literary characters around him, including A.E. George Russell, who we saw on a bicycle earlier, who's part of his audience as he's talking. And in fact, George Russell has this rather good line about Joyce himself. He said that Joyce was proud as Lucifer and writes verses perfect in their technique and sometimes beautiful in quality. Now, at the end of this episode, on the steps just where we're standing now, it feels like these two characters, Stephen and Bloom, are sort of spiralling around each other in the novel, and they've had near misses up till now. This is the first time they actually cross paths, but they don't speak. Bloom enters the library just as Stephen is leaving it.
Yes.
And Stephen steps out, and there's this rather lovely moment turning to look at Kildare Street, where it says, "The kind air defined the coins of houses in Kildare Street. No birds. Frail from the housetops, two plumes of smoke ascended, pluming, and in a floor of softness, softly were blown down." Yeah. Almost reminds me of that moment of The End of the Dead with the snow falling.
Yes.
It's similarly sort of...
Yes.
Now, the next episode in the book, episode 10, is an unusual one. It's known as The Wandering Rocks. Mm. And in some ways, it's a sort of interlude in the middle of the novel. It's one of the central chapters. And it's an interesting format because the episode is split up into 19 sections, each of which features a mini journey round the streets of Dublin. And they're all happening simultaneously. So certain characters appear in one and then reappear in another because the characters are crossing over.
Yes.
And I believe that Joyce, you know, sitting in Zurich or wherever he wrote this section of the novel, he would work with a ruler and a compass and a stopwatch, like working out exactly where people would be at certain points and how it could all mesh together. How do you see this episode of the novel?
In Proteus, Stephen thinks about nebeneinander, things beside each other, and then nacheinander, things that are in a sequence that come after each other. Uh-huh. So it's Joyce trying to calibrate the sense of the simultaneity of the city, of things that coexist, but also cut across each other, because you have interpolations, kind of what look like confused bits of text when you're reading Wandering Rocks, at least certainly for the first time, from a later section that disrupt an earlier one and that you only recognize later. So he's also alerting us to how the reading experience works, because we can't take in everything simultaneously. But he is playing with the idea of the urban and everything coexisting in different temporal planes and spatial planes.
So we're walking now through Merrion Square towards Hollis Street, where the maternity hospital is. We're going to skip quite lightly over the next three episodes of the novel. Sirens, Cyclops, and the controversial Nausicaa episode, which is, as we mentioned earlier, the reason why the serialization in America had to stop. And we've mentioned a couple of times his life partner, Nora Barnacle, and maybe this is a good moment to talk a little bit more about her. So they met in 1904. She was working as a hotel chambermaid in Dublin. And one of the reasons that Joyce sets the novel on the 16th of June is that that's thought to be the date of their first
walking out together. Yes, yeah. Yes, indeed. So the dates cluster together in June. And it's, in fact, the day they walk out towards the bay. And supposedly the day she first gives him a hand job. So there's a very sexual grounding element to the day. It's so been seen Nausicaa as romantic and sentimental, but there are other elements to it as well. And Nora worked close to where we are in Finn's Hotel, which no longer exists. But Nora is a remarkable figure. I suppose conundrum in some ways. She definitely was radical and experimental. You didn't need to be a writer or an author of Ulysses to be radical and experimental in the period. A Galway woman who had a troubled childhood, got beaten for seeing men, was brought up not by her mother but by a grandmother whom she loved. She's very stylish, obviously, loved the European fashions that she was able to wear later in life, always strikes a pose. So this is a woman who knew her place in the world, and she was being absolutely radical in going away with Joyce, unmarried, without declaring the relationship to almost anyone at all. Her family knew, I think, a little bit. Joyce's family knew a little bit more when they eloped, as one would say, in the period, to go to Europe, with no notion of what the future held for her, and she had no continental languages. And she was utterly dependent on Joyce. But she remained always a very independent figure. Sometimes she's castigated for not reading Ulysses enough. But she made Joyce's writing possible. And they were inseparable. When Joyce was in hospital, she stayed in the room with him overnight.
Well, didn't when Joyce's father heard that he was with a woman called Barnacle, he said, well, she'll stick to him anyway.
Yes.
And she did, yeah. Well, now we've moved off the square and we're standing on Hollis Street just outside the National Maternity Hospital, where I can see a plaque which says James Joyce set the Oxen of the Sun episode of Ulysses in the original National Maternity Hospital, which stood on this site. This brings us, of course, to the next episode, episode 14, known as the Oxen of the Sun, which in some ways it's a very key episode in the book, because it's the moment where Bloom and Stephen finally meet properly for the first time. It's also one of the hardest episodes in the novel.
I agree.
One of the hardest to read, and by all accounts, one of the hardest to write. I mean, Joyce said it took him 1,000 hours to write this one episode, which is not the longest.
And yet, it mirrors the project of Ulysses overall. Mm. Joyce's aim to get his revenge on English literature and the English language, but also to completely raid it, to use all the resources, literary resources, at his fingertips and on his bookshelves, and to use them in this holy Irish epic and do something different. So the different sections of Oxen of the Sun are difficult because they mirror or mimic different phases of English literature, are written in the style of different authors in different eras, yes, like Malory and so on.
You know, it's the National Maternity Hospital, and Bloom has, yes, popped in here to check on his friend, yeah, Mrs. Purefoy, who's been in labour for a few days, and mirroring the 9 months of pregnancy, Joyce follows the whole history of English language, yeah, literature through, yeah, 9 different, yes, sort of pastiches, really.
Before born babe bliss had, within womb one he worship, whatever in that one case done commodiously done was. A couch by midwives attended, with wholesome food, reposeful cleanest swaddles, as though forthbringing were now done, and by wise foresight set. But to this, no less of what drugs there is need, and surgical implements which are pertaining to her case, not omitting aspect of all very distracting spectacles in various latitudes by our terrestrial orb, offered together with images divine and human, the cogitation of which by subjunct females is to tumescence conductive, or eases issue in the high sunbright, well-built fair home of mothers when, ostensibly far gone and reproductive, it is come by her thereto to lie in, her term up.
I think a disconcerting facet of Oxen of the Sun is the offstage labour of Mina Purefoy, who's had multiple pregnancies, and this is a prolonged labour, because we don't see it. It's a kind of collateral effect of this language. So as the narratorial voices are giving birth to the different styles of English literature, this poor woman in her umpteenth, yes, pregnancy is giving birth to a child. It also seems strange that this is a gathering point for these men.
Yes, I mean, part of the reason Stephen is there is that he's with medical students.
Yes.
They're waiting to meet Buck Mulligan, of course,
yeah,
who is a medical student. And the medical students in Dublin were notorious at the time, weren't,
yes,
they, for being these drunken rakes, really.
Yeah, and most of the things that happen in Ulysses happen in public spaces rather than private ones. A lot on the street, of course, but in hotels, restaurants, bars, and places like the National Maternity Hospital. So it's another kind of meeting point where the city gets together and certain frictions are,
yes,
enacted.
And of course, in a novel that attempts to encapsulate every facet of human life, we've had death in the cemetery, we've now got the moment of birth. It's,
yes,
you know, everything comes into this novel.
Yes.
Apparently when Joyce was writing this section, he planned his writing by using a huge onion-shaped diagram that he would amend with different coloured crayons.
Yes.
And I can only imagine how complicated it must have been to sort of draw these strands together. Now, Stephen leaves with one of his friends to catch a train to visit a brothel in the Nighttown section of Dublin. And Bloom, in a sort of paternal way, decides to follow him discreetly and keep an eye on him to check he's okay. So let's, we're not going to catch a train, we're going to catch another taxi and follow the streets through the Nighttown part of the novel.
Yeah.
So we've hopped into a cab now, and maybe as we're sort of heading through this part of the city, we could talk about the 15th episode, Circe, which centres on Nighttown, the red light district of Dublin. The area was known as Monto. It was one of the worst slums in Western Europe, with something like 2,000 prostitutes in a very small area. And Stephen approaches on what Joyce calls the Mabbott Street entrance of Nighttown. And rather ironically, Mabbott Street has since been renamed James Joyce Street. I wonder what he'd think,
yes,
about that today. But this is the longest episode in the novel,
yes,
and in some ways it takes the form of almost a kind of dramatic performance. There are stage directions and speeches, and it's increasingly hallucinatory and psychedelic. Many ghosts appear. Paddy Dignam returns from the grave. We mentioned earlier that Shakespeare appears. Even little baby Rudy appears as an 11-year-old boy in Bloom's imagination. It's an extraordinary episode, isn't it, Anne?
Yes, the longest episode in Ulysses. It's been compared to cinema as well. Theatrical too. One of Joyce's ambitions as a young man was to write for theatre. There's also something transactional about the episode. Everything speaks, a bar of soap speaks, everything
right,
has a voice.
Yes.
And things are topsy-turvy. It's a world turned upside down.
We've stepped out of the cab now. We're on North Great George's Street, and there are school boys walking past us.
Belvedere students.
Coming from Belvedere, which of course was Joyce's school. Yes. The Jesuit school where he was a boy. So we can imagine him among these crowds of young students. At the end of Circe, Bloom finds Stephen having been knocked down by a couple of British soldiers, and Bloom comes to his assistance in the way that Joyce was once helped out on the street after he'd got into an altercation. And Bloom supports Stephen as they walk. They try and catch a cab, as we've just done. In fact, they can't catch it. And they end up in a cabman's shelter, one of these wooden structures, where a kind of motley group of night walkers have gathered, including this old sailor who tells them stories while they drink coffee and eat. And after this episode, known as Eumaeus, Bloom decides to take Stephen back to his home on Eccles Street. And so they walk back through the city, turning the novel back into a kind of full circle, bringing Bloom home to Eccles Street again.
Yes.
What parallel courses did Bloom and Stephen follow returning? Starting united both at normal walking pace from Beresford Place, they followed in the order named Lower and Middle Gardiner Streets and Mountjoy Square West, then, at a reduced pace each bearing left, Gardiner's Place by an inadvertence as far as the farther corner of Temple Street North, then, at a reduced pace, with interruptions of halt, bearing right, Temple Street North, as far as Hardwick Place. Approaching, disparate at relaxed walking pace, they crossed both the circus before George's church diametrically, the chord in any circle being less than the arc which it subtends.
Hello.
Hi.
Dorilla, hello.
Hello.
I'm Henry.
Hello, Henry.
And you know Anne, of course. So we've come into the James Joyce Centre now. We're standing in their beautiful courtyard, and it's such a pleasure to welcome Dorinna Gallagher, who's the director of the James Joyce Centre. And Dorinna, thank you so much for having us to visit. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. I told you about the seagulls, so here they are, arriving just on time.
Perfect. So, Dorinna, can you tell us a little bit about the centre and the work you do here?
The centre runs as a visitor centre, welcoming tourists and welcoming them to the centre to show them a little bit about Joyce's life and his literature. But also we're lucky enough to explore Joyce's legacy, which I'm really excited about. So we host lots of events and workshops, supporting artists and thinking about Joyce's legacy in lots of different ways.
Fabulous. Well, I'm sure he'd be just thrilled with the work you're doing, and it'd be great shortly to talk about the legacy of Ulysses and how it's gone on growing and growing since it was written. But I'm feeling quite sort of excited because here in the courtyard where we're standing, we've just been talking about how Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus are heading back to 7 Eccles Street from the cabman's shelter, and here we are standing by the original front door of 7 Eccles Street, which remarkably has been preserved and is now here at the centre. I mean, Dorinna, can you describe the door to us, how it looks today?
I love this door, and I'm so happy we have it here. People coming to visit the door as an act of pilgrimage, almost, and they can't believe they're here at this quite modest Georgian door with fanlight. It's in a little state of disrepair. Perhaps Molly and Leopold didn't get a chance to paint it and scrub the knockers. And So it's a modest Georgian door, not too tall. And I feel it's a really special symbol.
It's a wonderful thing to have preserved. And a door, especially, is such a sort of resonant object, isn't it? You're sort of looking at it, and I keep almost expecting it to open and see Leopold sort of coming out of it. It sort of feels like it's ready to move. So this is a penultimate episode of the book, known as Ithaca. Ithaca after the home of Odysseus, who returns to Ithaca at the end of the Odyssey. And this is Leopold Bloom at the end of his Odyssey, returning home to his Ithaca. And Anne, this again is one of those episodes which is written in a very kind of unusual style. It's a yes. Kind of question and answer, isn't it? It's a slightly sort of clipped interlocutor. It keeps asking questions and then a very pedantic responder. So what is Joyce doing in this episode?
It's question and answer, as you say, catechistic. And increasingly the styles take over in the latter half of Ulysses, but they're also interrogating things. The episodes are getting longer and longer, and they are establishing more of the world of the novel for us. And belatedly in Ulysses, we learn a lot more about the characters, so a lot of the details of Leopold Bloom are filled in, actually, in the Ithaca episode. Lots of other details are filled in, too. It's an episode that thinks about science. Bloom turns on the tap, for instance, so you get a long description of the origins of water. It's comic on that level
yes,
as well.
Yes, it's sort of crazily encyclopedic, isn't it?
Yes. But we learn everything about Bloom's measurements, the books in his library.
Yes, so initially they get into the house eventually, and Bloom makes a cup of cocoa for Stephen and in the kitchen. And then they go out into the backyard, rather like the yard we're standing in now, and they sort of look up at the stars, and there's a whole section sort of where the universe is suddenly looked at as a kind of
yes.
cosmos. And then they look down at the ground, and it goes down into the sort of
yes.
molecules of the...
They urinate together.
And they urinate together in the back garden here. And then at one point, Stephen decides to leave, and this is his exit from the novel. And he goes out of the back gate of the yard. You can imagine him leaving from the space we're standing in now. And the description of his parting is the sound of the double reverberation of retreating feet on the heaven-born earth, the double vibration of a Jew's harp in the resonant lane. But now we're really approaching the end of the novel, and Bloom, you know, he's exhausted, it's late at night, it's time to go to bed. And he goes and lies down in the bed with Molly. So for this final episode, episode 18, Penelope, which takes place in the marital bed, but then through flashbacks in all sorts of other places, why don't we move to a different location? Let's head back into the Joyce Center and find somewhere to finish the story.
We're going right up the stairs, so get your thighs of steel.
So, Dorinda, we've come up to the top of the James Joyce Centre to an amazing little hidden alcove with a single bed in it. What is this room? How have you made it up?
This room is a recreation of one of Joyce's rooms in Trieste. During his time there. You can see the lovely Italian dark wood of
yes.
the furniture and the beautiful lace on the windows. Pictures of Joyce's children and Nora and a clatter of books everywhere.
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful space, and it's a perfect kind of stand-in for this, our final yeah. episode in the novel, which, of course, takes place in the bed of Leopold and Molly Bloom at the top of their house on Eccles Street. Now, this episode is perhaps one of the most famous from the novel, I'd say. It's a soliloquy which occurs inside Molly's head. It's famously got very little punctuation. It's almost entirely one sentence, really. You know, we've talked a little bit about the streams of consciousness inside this novel, but this is the kind of stream of consciousness par excellence at the end. It's a real tour de force, this piece of writing. And we're introduced to this bed before we see it, because in the previous episode, it's introduced as the bed of conception and of birth, of consummation of marriage and of breach of marriage. So this bed is the kind of nexus of the relationship between Leopold and Molly. It's all yes. happened here on this spot.
Oddly, Molly seems hardly ever to leave that bed. So it puts the main female character in Ulysses in an odd position. As we've been talking about earlier, she's always off stage. We only see her in parts, an arm. As an episode, it falls outside the schema. It's at some indeterminate time, is what I mean by that. It's somewhere in the middle of the night. Molly falling asleep, thinking unconsciously, going beyond consciousness into some other zone. And she has a very striking history. She's actually more Jewish than Bloom himself, in that we discover she has a Jewish mother, Lunita Laureda. And she thinks back to her memories of Gibraltar as well
as... She grew up in Gibraltar, right? Yes. Quite an exotic location.
Yes, so she has a Spanish, Jewish, Irish background. And she's thinking about her early loves in Gibraltar and her life as a young girl there, as well as her meetings with Bloom. And the kind of language that she uses is very striking, of course. Joyce purportedly was imitating Nora's style to a degree, producing a kind of feminine discourse in this loosened up language. And there's some kind of sense in which everything is relaxing now at this hour of the night. As author joins forces with this female other voice, takes over the novel, but ends it wonderfully with these yeses, which might mean anything. They seem, of course, affirmatory to us. But Joyce said he chose yes because it was the least emphatic word in the English language.
When I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used, or shall I wear a red yes? And how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well, him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I, yes, to say, yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breasts all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said yes, I will, yes.
There's something about a signature towards the future at the end of Ulysses that Joyce very definitely wanted to have there as a sense of an ending. So not closure, a future is opening up.
Uh-huh. I love that idea of his final outpouring, of being a kind of freeing and a looking to the future. Because now that we've reached the end of this enormous... novel, maybe this is the moment to think about how it has continued to live beyond the pages and over the years, and talk a bit about its legacy. I mean, one of the ways in which Ulysses famously remains alive is that every year on Bloomsday, great celebrations occur across the city of Dublin. And Dorina, I know the Joyce Centre is really sort of integral to those celebrations. So can you describe what happens on Bloomsday? What kind of things go on in Dublin?
Dublin comes alive on Bloomsday. It really is extraordinary. From Sandy Cove to Sandy Mount to Howth Head and everything in between, people just come to Dublin from all over the world, or Dubliners themselves put on a hat, they join with friends, they have a picnic, they sing the songs from the novel, they read extracts, and then they'll go to more organised events that happen to be on, theatre performances, concerts. People want to have their own odyssey on that day to follow the journeys that are through the book. So what strikes me always is the rest of the year, people think it's unreadable and so difficult and nobody knows. And for that day, everybody
it's
is a Joycean scholar and everyone has their favourite song and everybody is a Molly or a Blazes. Or
Well, so listeners, you know what to do next June 16th and where you want to be. You want to be here in Dublin.
Aww.
My final question is, how do you feel the legacy of Ulysses has changed over the years? And do you think it's going to continue changing?
I think it has certainly changed from the initial reactions, which we talked about a little bit earlier. It's not a dirty, scandalous book for us anymore. It's still radical and revolutionary. It's been hugely influential. So I think you could scarcely find an artist of any ilk composers, or visual artists, painters, writers certainly, who have not been influenced by Joyce in some way. So he's become part of the DNA of 20th century and 21st century literature. And Ulysses always depends on its readers. Joyce turned his readers into co-creators of the text. So an element that I think keeps renewing itself and won't go away is the joy, the pleasure, the obsessional devotion of the discovery of Joyce and Ulysses and everything that one finds in this novel. And then changes will happen to the degree that it's a novel that mirrors us as well as we read it. So we bring our concerns to the novel. So new views of sexuality, current concerns with the environment and questions of justice now motivate, I think, new readings of Ulysses and of Finnegan's Wake in turn. So the novel changes us, certainly, as we read it, but we also change the readings that are possible of the novel because of our own particular interests and where we are historically.
Thank you. It reminds me of the line from Richard Ellman's biography where he says that Joyce's heroes are not easy liking, his books are not easy reading. He does not wish to conquer us, but to have us conquer him. There are, in other words, no invitations, but the door is ajar. And I hope that this conversation today will help future readers to push that door further open and walk in to 7 Eccles Street, perhaps. Well, Irina, thank you so much for welcoming us into the James Joyce Centre. It's been a wonderful place to finish our tour of Dublin today. And thank you so much for being with us today. You've been a wonderful guest, and it's been such a pleasure exploring Joyce's Dublin with you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Professor Anne Fogarty, Irina Gallagher and the James Joyce Centre, Seamus Cannon and the Friends of Joyce Tower Society, to the Penguin Audio team for the clips of Patrick Gibson's reading of the novel, and to our kind partners, Penguin Classics. I'm Henry Elliott, the producer is Andrea Rangecroft, and the music is by Don Gould. If you enjoyed this episode of On the Road, please spread the word and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'll leave you with this. In 1922, the young critic Arthur Power visited Joyce in Paris. Joyce pointed out of the window of his apartment at the son of the concierge who was playing on the steps. "One day," he said, "that boy will be a reader of Ulysses." Joyce wrote his book for ordinary readers. He gave a signed first edition to his favourite waiter at Fouquet's restaurant. "I know it is no more than a game," wrote Joyce while he was working on Finnegan's Wake, "but it is a game that I've learned to play in my own way. Children may just as well play as not. The ogre will come in any case."
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us.
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.